Welcome to the UAlbany News Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah O'Carroll. I have with me Tomoko Udo, an assistant professor in the School of Public Health. Udo is researching the connection between eating disorders and psychological impairment in chronic medical conditions. First off, can you help us understand the scope of the problem of eating disorders in the United States? On average, just how many people are affected each year by anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorders, respectively?
So I just been using a national epidemiology data that's got over 36,000 individuals from, people who are not institutionalized. And based on that data, we found that anorexia nervosa is about lifetime prevalence is 0.8%, and bulimia nervosa is 0.28%, and binge eating disorder is 0.85%. So that's lifetime. And it is much lower than major psychiatric disorders such as depression or substance use disorder. Depression could be about 20%, maybe over more than 20% lifetime prevalence. Substance use disorder, it could be anywhere, depending on what it is, could be anywhere between less than 1%, but alcohol use disorder is, 30%. So it is definitely lower than those disorders, but definitely the impact of the disorders, as severe as, maybe potentially more severe than those disorders.
Okay, so compared to other types of health issues that we're seeing, perhaps eating disorders are on the lower end of the spectrum, but these still seem significant. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, and the eating disorder definitely impact everyone. People tend to think that it's a young white female disorder, but what we found and consistently reported by our literature is that's not true. It can happen in male, it can happen in any age, and it can happen in any race.
Okay. So what kinds of health-related consequences are commonly associated with eating disorders? Because it's not just trying to lose weight or to have better body image, but what are some other effects?
So all eating disorders are highly associated with other psychiatric disorders, including substance use disorder, personality disorder. We found that based on the same data set, we found that for bulimia and binge eating disorder, over 90% of individuals who met the criteria for binge eating disorder, bulimia nervosa diagnosis, met other psychiatric disorder diagnosis. And even for the anorexia, it was 80-something percent. So people tend, if they meet the criteria for eating disorder, then they tend to also meet at least one other psychiatric disorder diagnosis.
Okay.
In terms of health effects, binge eating disorder is highly, highly associated with obesity and metabolic disorders. Anorexia have a high risk for osteoporosis, some other, anemia and so on, and bulimia also. Those disorder because affect is it's eating. So they tend to have some intestinal problem as well.
And that seems like that would just compound the issue if you're trying to lose weight and that's why you're throwing up in the bathroom or something. And then that only makes you gain weight and then just makes all of those other mental effects worse, it sounds like.
Yes. And most importantly, all these disorders associated with functional problem in life. So all individual with any anorexia, it doesn't matter, bulimia, binge eating disorder, they tend to feel guilty and ashamed that they have these disorders. And so they try to hide it from people, and depending on severity, for example, if you engage in binge eating behavior a couple of times per day, you may not want to go out eating with people, and then you might not want to interact with people because they want to hide their disorder. And so that can impact people, their relationship with others, and they, just functionality, they feel like they're highly impacted by disorder.
Okay. I was also hearing when you were sharing an answer to the first question that this is sort of a root cause that then spawns other issues. And at the beginning, you were sharing numbers on how this eating disorders results in slightly lower numbers than other types of national health issues. So is it possible that some people don't want to share about the eating disorders, but will say that they're suffering from depression or something, and that can result in different numbers?
That could be possible, but this number is lower than some estimate that we have, you know, obtained in the past, but it's not significantly lower. So again, if you go back to the number of people actually meet the criteria for eating disorder, that is definitely lower than those. But, you know, we don't know, I personally don't know, you know, what disorder happened first and so on. Binge eating disorder, for example, is later onset compared to other two disorders. Anorexia definitely is teenager, 16, 17 years old. Bulimia, maybe a few years later. Binge eating disorder is 25. That was the average that we found at onset. And so depending on what other disorder you're looking at in terms of comorbidity, it could be earlier or it could be later. So, yeah.
But. Okay. And how likely are people suffering from eating disorders to seek help?
So what we found was the treatment-seeking behavior is very low. And so this particular data set also asked about, have you ever seen any help? So it's not, we're not just talking about psychiatric, you know, psychologist or counselor. We talked about even support group and so on. But including that, on average, for anorexia, you know, about one-third. A little over one-third of people reported seeking any help in their lifetime. And bulimia is a little over 60%, and binge eating disorder is about 50%, I believe. So many people don't seek any kind of help, even including self-help and support. And when you look at the counselor psychologist that we consider a specialized treatment, number is less than one-third, so very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the problem, I think, is that there are not many specialized treatment centers for eating disorder, even within the New York, as just practice that are specialized in the eating disorders, only three across the state.
Wow.
So that's part of the problem. And in terms of who are less likely to seek help, it's tend to be men are less likely to seek treatment compared to women, and racial and ethnic minorities are less likely to seek treatment compared to Caucasians.
Okay. And can you perhaps speak to why that might be?
So it's just, we are just hypothesizing why it could be. But again, it comes back to this notion that eating disorder is primarily for young female, Caucasian female. And so maybe that they don't, even when they're experiencing eating disorder symptoms, they might not think that that is a problem or that's what it is, or feel ashamed, especially with men. They tend to report some shame that they're developing eating disorder, having a body image problem. And so they don't seek treatment because they're ashamed. They also tend to seek, those are the populations that tend not to seek treatment from the specialized treatment. They tend to go through primary care. And so it might be that, again, when they go to the primary care, probably doctors don't think to ask whether they have an eating problem, because they're not, you know, fitting this category of young Caucasian female. So that might lead to less detection of the problem when they're experiencing eating disorder symptoms.
Now, it also looked like from your study, you were looking at the connection between eating disorders and suicide attempts.
Yes.
Can you share a little bit about what that research entailed?
We found that the lifetime history of eating disorder is strongly associated with report of suicide attempt in their lifetime. Interesting part that we found was anorexia actually have a different subtypes. And so one of them is the restriction. And so people kind of focus on restricting their calorie intake and so on. And other type would be binge eating and a purging, and then also do other, you know, body image problem. And those binge eating and purging subtype had the highest percentage of reporting suicide attempt across all the binge eating disorder diagnosis that we looked at. So we don't know why. We weren't able to explore the part of why, but that was something that we found very interesting and something interesting to pursue, I guess.
Okay. And for this study, you also were looking at diagnostic criteria for eating disorders. Why does the language matter in terms of diagnosis and treatment? And what kinds of changes did you observe that were interesting or that perhaps made you look at the problem differently?
So the why we decided to use this data set and focus on the prevalence of eating disorder based on this data set is this was the first epidemiologic survey in the U.S. after the diagnostic criteria changed in 2013. And so in terms of eating disorder, there are some major changes happen. So anorexia, it used to require absence of menstrual cycle, that they removed it. They're no longer so strict about BMI requirement. They kind of loosened up the criteria that way. Binge eating disorder and bulimia, also they kind of loosened up the criteria of the frequency. Another important thing is that binge eating disorder was never formal diagnostic criteria prior to DSM-5. It was part of other eating disorder criteria, and so they also made it into individual diagnostic criteria. So there are many reasons to look at the prevalence in the U.S. because the last time that happened was 2007, which is more than 10 years ago, and so it was important to update the data. So this is not necessarily just for this particular data set, but there always is challenge in terms of doing epidemiologic survey on the psychiatric disorders, and there are many, and we all studies try to look at all the disorders, and it takes a lot of time. And so we need to limit how long the survey should take, because people get burdened, people may not want to answer a question. And so when that happened, you can only really limit what kind of question people can ask. And this particular survey done by NIAAA, this is the third time that they did it. And prior to surveys, they actually didn't include eating disorders. Part of it because, again, it's lower prevalence compared to other major psychiatric disorders. So they may not be able to get sufficient number of people to meet the criteria. That could be one of the reasons. But either way, they added it. And so that's another new aspect that our study highlighted. And there were some criticism in terms of how the questions are asked for the eating disorder for that.
Criticism from other
peers.
Okay.
Our peers. And they felt like it wasn't asking enough question, I guess. But so that was the limitation of this data set and limitation of our study overall because we were using this data set. But we also want to highlight that also highlighted the need to do more research and data collection, more population level understanding of eating disorders, and it also led to highlighting how little epidemiologic research been done, at least in the U.S. Around eating disorder. And so there definitely are ways to make these questions better to capture better the eating disorder symptoms and people who might have an eating disorder better. But our hope really has been to push this ahead based on this data set and then kind of, push the field so that people will be motivated to study more at the population level.
What I'm hearing is when the questions are limited, then that will inherently exclude some people from being in that category and then getting diagnosed and getting treatment.
Right.
Is that right?
Right, because sometimes you have to just not ask. If someone said no, a lot of times that we built the survey so that if someone said no to a certain question, they just skip the whole thing. And so that kind of limits, what other, because eating disorder, anorexia, but bulimia, binge eating disorder, they are the major one, but there are also other type of eating disorder that we could look at. But that we couldn't do that just because it just was not asked. No, the rest of the questions were not asked. And so those are the limitation, but it's not the, you know, it's just not specific to this particular, it's just happened with the psychiatric epidemiology survey studies just because of the consideration of burdening the participants. So you have to kind of do cost-benefit analysis in the sense that what you include in a survey and what can we do and what you want to study, like what you want to get at most.
Because if it's a comprehensive questionnaire that takes a really long time, then people might get discouraged or say, I'm not going to handle this.
Right.
Okay.
And so, you know, there are a lot of way to make surveys better, and especially with the eating disorder, definitely we see that there are a better way to structure the question and ask the question, but again, we're hoping that this is going to stimulate interest in doing so in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
So more research on this, what sounds like is still an emerging area of research, mm-hmm. but what other takeaways are there here for public health officials seeking to address this issue? It sounds like from earlier you were saying more specialized treatment centers would be good, more reporting. Mm-hmm. What else is there that could really help this?
If you think about going to the primary care, you mentioned a little bit, but your own experience and my own experience, that they ask about whether you eat or not and your weight. And, you know, if you go to the doctor's appointment, they talk about that, but they really don't ask how you eat. So are you skipping meal? You know, even that could be, if they do it on a regular basis, that is actually, especially to control their weight, that is considered as disorder eating behavior. But I don't think doctors really don't ask that kind of question. They just want to know if you're eating and then, you know, what you're eating, but not how. So those are maybe, you know, encouraging that kind of training so that there, you know, more detection can happen, be good. And also, like any other psychiatric disorder, including substance use disorder and depression and other mental health, I think it's really important to remove the stigma around eating disorder, and so that people feel more comfortable about sharing their story or seeking help when they feel like they shouldn't feel ashamed that they have that disorder.
And that seems to go beyond just public health officials, but you and I as daily citizens and being friends to others and trying to be caring and not saying, oh, you're a man and you have an eating disorder? How weird. But trying to normalize that.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Tomoko, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Walbany News Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah O'Carroll. And that was Tomoko Udo from the School of Public Health. You can let us know what you thought of the episode by emailing us at mediarelations@albany.edu, or you can find us on Twitter @UAlbanyNews.